Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Four Palestinians were killed and 30 wounded this morning when undiscovered ordnance from last summer's Israeli war on Gaza exploded. The four victims were all from the same family. A year ago at this time, the 51-day war was still raging, and it was ostensibly triggered by the killing of three Jewish Israeli teenagers by members of a Palestinian organization. Israelis and even Americans grieved for the boys. In the past few weeks, Jewish Israeli settlers and right-wingers and soldiers have killed several Palestinian children. 18-month-old Ali Dawab Shah died when a Palestinian home was engulfed in flames after settlers firebombed it. 15-year-old Laith al-Khalidi was shot in the back by an Israeli sniper immediately after. And Muhammad al-Kasbeh, as well as Muhammad al-Masri, were shot and killed in separate incidents. But there has been little attention paid to the lives of Palestinian children, symbolizing the impact of the long-standing Israeli occupation. My guest is Eve Spangler. She is a sociologist and human rights activist, and she's the author of the book Understanding Israel-Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. Welcome to Uprising, Eve.
Thank you very much, Sonali. That was a wonderful intro.
Thanks for joining us. Now, there was a swift and strong reaction from Israeli officials calling the firebombing of the Dawab Shah home a terrorist attack when the 18-month-old baby died. How important was that condemnation?
I think it is, from their point of view as publicity, a necessary condemnation, but a bad faith one. Obviously, the individual settler who chose to open that window and lob that firebomb into a family home where an infant was sleeping made an individual choice for which he can be held responsible. I use the male pronoun advisedly because there were witnesses who say it was men. When people make individual choices, they make it in the context of their society and the messages that they've gotten from their society. And in the case of an Israeli settler in the West Bank, his whole life is based on illegality. The settlements are illegal. His whole life is based on the Israeli state supporting that choice of being living illegally on other people's land, supports it materially with water, with roads, with the electricity grid, supports it financially with tax breaks, with better schools in settlements, and supports it morally and culturally. That settler makes the choice in the context in which he has watched the Israeli Defense Forces protecting other settlers who burn Palestinian orchards. So the notion of arson and firebombing is in that culture. That settler makes that choice having listened to perhaps Rabbi Eli Ben Dahan, who is now the second in command of the military government that governs the lives of Palestinians in the West Bank. And Rabbi Dahan has said that Palestinians are not human. They are subhuman beasts. People, of course, react adversely to the horrible racism of that statement. But I think they underestimate its importance, because if you are a clergy person in any of the monotheisms, Christianity, Judaism, Islam, you believe in a single God, and that makes us all brothers and sisters. So then, if you want to systematically mistreat or expel people, you have a dilemma and a contradiction. And then just announcing that some number of people are subhuman goes to resolving that contradiction. So that settler who made this horrible choice of throwing a firebomb into a family home did so on his or her own, but did so in a context that made that choice all too easy.
And even though the Israeli government did verbally condemn the attack and the killing of the baby, when Palestinian babies grow up, particularly boys grow up into teens, they seem to be routinely considered as acceptable targets for the Israeli military. In the case of the baby, it was a settler. It was an individual who, could sort of say that he acted on his own and acted as an individual. But the Israeli Defense Forces routinely kill Palestinian teenage boys. I mentioned three names just in the last few months alone. I mean, what's really the difference between the vigilante violence of settlers and the militarized violence of the IDF?
I guess the firepower of the weapons, which are your and my tax dollars at work, because Israel receives almost unlimited financial, military, and diplomatic support from the United States. So I guess those are differences, maybe distinctions without much difference.
Right. Now, between the what's happening, of course, within Israel is also interesting. This past week, not only were Palestinians victims of right-wing Israelis, but Israelis as well. There was an ultra-Orthodox Israeli man named Yishai Shlissel who stabbed six people during Jerusalem's gay pride parade. A 16-year-old girl was killed. And the ultra-Orthodox communities have been very useful for Israel to colonize Palestinian land. But when, of course, they attack fellow Israelis, it's not, this sort of presents a bit of a very serious paradox for Israel, doesn't it?
Well, it's certainly a publicity problem, in some measure also because Israel engages in a lot of what you could call pinkwashing, which is to appeal to Westerners on the grounds of being so Western and tolerant of homosexuality. As a very good Palestinian friend of mine says, there are no pink checkpoints in the wall where you can go and say, hey, I'm gay, and then they say, oh, come on in. And in fact, the whole pinkwashing thing is also a bit of a sham, because one of the things that the Israeli state routinely does and sweeps through the gay bars and communities in Tel Aviv is if they catch a Palestinian who's gay, they try to force him into becoming a collaborator, and they try to blackmail him with outing him in his own community. So, you know, the pinkwashing claim is problematic. But I think in general, the Zionist political project, which is to create an ethno-religiously exclusive state in an area, in a physical geographic space that has been from biblical times forward extremely multicultural and multiracial, creates all kinds of problems for Israelis. And then, of course, Israeli society is not monolithic. And so then there also come to be conflicts within Israeli society about whether you suppress or whether you ethnically cleanse, how aggressive you can be in pursuit of your aims, what your timeline is for achieving ethnic cleansing. So all of those, the project is inherently conflictual, I think.
Right. And the existential threat to Israel that Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, constantly invokes also very seriously impacts regional political issues, such as, for example, the U.S. attempt to have a nuclear agreement with Iran this week. President Obama is, made a very strong statement. He said it would be an abrogation of my constitutional duty to let Israel interfere with this deal. But setting Obama aside for the moment, Netanyahu is going to be meeting with members of Congress in the next few weeks who are being flown to Israel by AIPAC. Every single freshman congressman but three are traveling to Israel to meet with Netanyahu. He's going to try to convince them to vote against this Iran deal. Is there any other country in the world that has this kind of relationship with the United States?
Not that I can think of. Certainly Iceland isn't doing that sort of thing. And no, I don't think any other country is so blatantly intervening in the domestic politics of the United States. We do align with other countries like England out of whatever historic friendship and interest, but I don't know of any other foreign dignitary who would accept an invitation to the Congress that contravenes all protocol. So this is the unique Israeli-American relationship that we're seeing play out here.
And is President Obama, even though, of course, in action he's been pretty pro-Israel, how close has he come to, compared to other U.S. presidents, to at least verbally, standing up to Israel, if you will?
Well, a few other presidents have done so. George Bush the elder did so in a round of negotiations when in 1989-1990 the Soviet Union had just collapsed and Israel was looking for a lot of money to support Jewish immigration to Israel. George Herbert Walker Bush tried to say a freeze on settlement building is the price of continued uncritical American support. He was a one-term president. And so the Clintons limited themselves to saying this or that was unhelpful, but they never cut foreign aid, they never cut military aid, they never cut diplomatic support at the UN. So this is for Obama carving a path. He's not the only person who's ever stepped out on that path, but he's one of the very few.
Eve Spangler, let's turn to specifically some of the things you discuss in your book, Understanding Israel-Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. It was interesting that the word race is the first word in the subtitle of your book, and you have a chapter in it entitled Zionism, the Idea That Changed Everything. How do you explain Zionism in a nutshell to an American who might, you know, really have no idea what it means?
Okay, well, I think the way Americans can grasp it best is through something they do know, which is the civil rights movement and the history of Black America. So you have Jews in Christian Europe, interestingly, not Jews in the Muslim world, where they were much safer and much better treated than they were in Christian Europe, which was quite anti-Semitic. But you have Jews in Christian Europe, the target of anti-Semitism. You have Black people in America with that whole ugly history, of course, of racism and lynchings and intimidations and Jim Crow. And so you have communities of Jews in Christianity and Blacks in America who have a problem with their host society. And a great many people, of course, use the assimilationist response. They just want to go along to get along. If they have to hold a job and get the kids off to school and remember to send their mother-in-law a birthday card, that's work enough. And that would be the assimilationist strategy. There are people who have the energy, the foresight, the courage to want to reform the system that mistreats them. And so you have clearly the civil rights movement in the United States, and you have often socialism is the tool chosen by Jews in Europe. And then you have a very small minority of people who think nothing will work and they want to exit. So you have the Back to Africa movement in the Black community in America, and you have Zionism in Christian Europe. And this is a political project to create a sort of ethno-religious or ethno-racially exclusive state for the safety of your people somewhere else, away. And I think the parallels are really exceptionally strong, with the exception that we have to admit that Israel is certainly economically more successful than Liberia. But that said, both Back to Africa and Zionism didn't actually appeal to most of the people who were supposed to benefit from it. Most people said, you want to go where? You want to do what? See you later. And so they survived on the fact that their leaders were very astute and could create political lobbying efforts, could fundraise, could recruit settlers. They succeeded by having allies. Some of those allies were real human rights advocates who just wanted everybody to be able to go wherever they wanted to go. But many of their allies were profoundly racist. And for them, Back to Africa or Zionism was a way to get Black people out of America or Jews out of Christianity. And finally, they made very opportunistic choices about where the colony, where the settlement was going to be, based on where great powers would cede land to them. And they both rode roughshod over the rights of the indigenous population. So I see a real parallel between Zionism and the Back to Africa movement, which is something that also I think Americans don't think about all that much. But if they think about it even a little bit, they will have an intuitive grasp of it.
Has the idea of Zionism changed in recent years? Can one be a Zionist and be pro-Palestinian today?
Well, today, in the political climate of the Netanyahu regime, that is, of course, very difficult. I think early in the Zionist project, there was certainly a debate between a kind of cultural Zionism, which saw Palestine as a homeland for Jews. It is historically probably the most multiracial, multi-ethnic place in the world, situated on the land bridge between Europe and Asia and Africa and Asia. Everybody's been there from biblical times forward. And so there were Zionists who talked about a homeland and adding themselves into the mix in a respectful way, which, for example, the Samaritan community in Nablus, a very militant city in the West Bank, there's a community of Jews, the Samaritans, who are treated as Jews by the Israeli state, Israeli passports, Israeli license plates, and they are unmolested by their Palestinian neighbors, who say they come to be our neighbors not to be our overlords. We have no problem with them. And, you know, when I first heard that, I thought, well, you know, I'd like to see that for myself. But now I have gone to Nablus and I have seen it for myself. So there was that strand of Zionism. I guess, hypothetically, it could be revived, the kind of cultural Zionism. Members of that movement were some pretty smart people. Martin Buber, I have some quotes here. I'll have to turn away from the camera for just a moment. But Martin Buber said that excessive nationalism could lead only to, quote, a tiny state of Jews, completely militarized and unsustainable. And he said that, you know, 50, 60 years ago. Hannah Arendt said, a Jewish homeland should never be sacrificed to the pseudo-sovereignty of a Jewish state built on Arab suppression. So there were those voices, but, you know, they were not the voices that prevailed. The choice pretty early in the history of Zionist settlement was to build an exclusively Jewish community in Palestine.
And today, the kind of expansionism that Israel is engaging in other parts of the world would be roundly criticized. And Israel does it in a very interesting way, of course, allowing settlers in the West Bank. Now, they were kicked out of Gaza, certainly, after many, many years. But in the West Bank, you see these settlements springing up. When the Israeli government refuses to let them expand, of course, they react violently. Like in the case of the killing of the 18-month-old Ali Dawab Absha. But in general, we see these settlements that are eventually so large that they become connected by roads, and it becomes a sort of de facto annexation of yes. Palestinian land. The same sort of thing is done through the so-called apartheid wall or separation wall. Israeli calls it a security wall, where basically Palestinians little by little are losing their land, this piecemeal colonization. What is the end game? I mean, you wrote your book as a way to educate Americans about this conflict who don't know much about it. How do you explain what Netanyahu's, or not even his specifically, but what is Israel's end game for Palestinians? The hope that they may either assimilate into Israeli society or simply be absorbed into other Arab nations and stop bothering Israelis?
Well, I think... You know, the history of Israel and Palestine is in some ways historically unique because there's a fairly constant cast of characters, the Zionists on the one hand and the Palestinians on the other. And they have always been very explicit about their aims, and they've actually usually acted according to what they've said. So it's a unique case in which people say what they mean and mean what they say and do what they say. Mm-hmm. And Zionism from early on talked about the transfer. By which they meant ethnic cleansing. And, you know, it came in waves during the establishment of the State of Israel. It was militarily executed, and you drove people out by military means. The dilemma was then in the occupation in 1967, they took over land to which Palestinians had fled. So they got all the land they wanted and have always said they wanted, is now under their control militarily. But then they've also taken this large, you know, mass of, for them, undigestible Palestinians. And so, you know, the end game continues, I think, to be as much as possible expulsion and transfer. Now, since mass killings and rounding up people and putting them in cattle trucks and driving them across the border makes for very bad optics, the means they use, I think, are more often what a Palestinian political scientist has called sociocide. That is, they're not killing individual bodies, but they're making life unlivable. They're making the society untenable so that people will leave. They do this on a personal level by announcing, for example, that anything for which a Palestinian needs a permit, which is pretty much anything they would want to do, they can get a permit if they're willing to inform on their neighbors. Well, you know, that sows the seeds of distrust in a community. They're impounding bank accounts. They have 500 checkpoints in an area one-fifth the size of New Jersey. So goods rot in trucks. They've made it economically untenable. They've made it politically untenable by arresting elected legislators. And so people gradually, they hope, will choose to leave. And those who don't are being compressed into areas that are very much like Indian reservations. They're not contiguous. they don't have good infrastructure, and they're separated from one another and completely surrounded by settlements. And those are the Area A cities.
And finally, how important is it for Americans to educate themselves about something that seemingly is so far away from us? I mean, of course, not talking about my direct audience who are quite educated about this issue. Mm-hmm. We discuss it a lot. But in general, for Americans, for the people that you hope will read your book, how important is it to educate themselves about a conflict on the other side of the globe?
Well, I think it's very important because, among other things, on the most pragmatic level, it's about 10 billion of our tax dollars every year that are supporting this. It is, according to someone very mainstream like General Petraeus, a thing that is making Americans around the world less safe. It is, you know, the promised land of the Jews, the holy land of the Christians, right? Because Palestinians are the first Christians. Nazareth, Bethlehem, Jerusalem, those are all Palestinian cities in Roman Palestine. So it's important to churches. I think it's important to everyone.
Well, I want to thank you on that note for joining us today, and best of luck with your book, Eve.
Thank you very much. This was a wonderful interview.
My guest is Eve Spangler. She is a sociologist and human rights activist, and her book is entitled Understanding Israel-Palestine, Race, Nation, and Human Rights in the Conflict. This is Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar.